Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
This episode of Amateur Traveler is sponsored by DK Eyewitness Travel Guides. These colorful guidebooks are filled with great information and are one of my favorite guidebooks. I have 20 of them here on my bookshelf. Learn more at dk.com. I got my bags packed on a roll. I'm heading out there and I'm ready to go. Looking real good in my passport photo. Amateur Traveler, episode 451. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about cathedrals and mosques, Roman ruins, and flamenco as we go to Sevilla in Spain. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. We'll be hearing more from our sponsor, DK Eyewitness Travel Guides, later on in the show, but first, let's hear more about Seville, or Sevilla. I'd like to welcome to the show Kat Gay, coming to us from sunshineandsiestas.com and coming to talk to us about Seville, Spain, or Sevilla, Spain, depending on which you prefer. Kat, welcome to the show.
Thank you, hola.
And first, let's answer that question. If I'm a tourist and I'm going there, how should I pronounce it?
It really depends on who you ask, Chris. The thing with Sevillanos is that they're just beginning to speak English for touristic purposes, for the simple fact that there are no jobs in Seville, and it's really important to speak in English. So you can say Seville, you can say Sevilla quite interchangeably, and there's absolutely no problem in being understood.
Okay. And what led you, currently live in Seville, in Sevilla, what led you there?
When I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Iowa, I studied journalism with a specification in Spanish, and it was always my dream to go to a Spanish-speaking country and become fluent. But with everything that I was doing at my university between activities and studying and working, the only way I was able to go was through a summer program. And I studied up in northern Spain, as a matter of fact, in a city called Valladolid. And once I came back from Spain, in the very same breath that my mom welcomed me and I said I was happy to be home and I was tired and I wanted a Chicago-style hot dog, was I'm moving back to Spain. So I began, once my studies picked up again, I began looking for a way to get back to Spain and found a teaching program. I did not study to be a teacher. I come from a family of teachers and said that I would never become a teacher. And now I'm a teacher. So it's kind of one of those things that led me back to Spain simply because I wanted to become fluent. I really love Spanish culture. It's something that intrigues me. It's something that surprises me every day. I've lived in Seville for 7 years and I'm still surprised with what I'm learning about the country and the language, the food, the wine. And the reason that I'm in Seville is actually not because of my own choosing. When I studied abroad, I went down to Andalusia just for the weekend. I was there for about 4 or 5 days and was between Seville and Cadiz and Granada and really fell in love with Granada and the tapas culture and the Alhambra and the history. And If you've never been to Granada, it's a gorgeous city and
it is
a place that's really enchanting. So I applied to the teaching program with the hopes of being placed in Granada, and I was placed just outside of Seville. So when push came to shove, I was more interested in Spain and getting to Spain and having a legal way to work in Spain, and ended up really enjoying Sevilla, have a nice group of friends, love the city itself, just bought a house there. So I think it's safe to say that I'll be there either until my mortgage runs out or until I'm ready to move away.
Well, and you skipped that you also now have a fiance from there. So
I do. A very Sevillano fiance.
Excellent. So first of all, let's put it on a map. Where are we in Spain?
Way down south. Okay. Someone who is from the northern part of the United States. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get away from the cold Chicago winters that I was used to. So when it came to decide where I wanted to teach in what region, the reason I chose Andalusia is because it's enormous. It's down south. You've got mountains, you've got beaches, you've got rivers, you've got plains. And for me, it's the typical Spain that you see when you think about Spain, with the bullfighting, the flamenco, the wine, the sangria, the sunshine. So Seville itself is the capital of Andalusia, which is actually the most populous autonomous region in all of Spain. In Seville alone, in the capital, there are 700,000. And when you look at it on a map, you're talking about the southwestern corner. So we're only about an hour from the coast and an hour from the Portuguese border. Mm-hmm. A little bit further inland. So we're not quite on the coast, but we have a river. And when you come from a place like the Midwest, you don't really need the coastline. So we've kind of got it all within an hour's drive. There are mountains up north, mountains to the west, mountains to the east, mountains to the south. And to the south and the west, we've got quite a lovely amount of beaches.
Excellent. So what kind of itinerary would you recommend for somebody who is going to come and spend 1 week in and around Seville?
What's really great about Seville, Chris, is that being the hub of Andalusia, you've got a lot of options to be able to travel around, whether it's with a personal car. The public transportation system is pretty great, considering you're kind of not so much in the boondocks, but mm-hmm. you're a little bit further away from central Andalusia.
Well, you're also a high-speed train ride from Madrid, so not difficult to get to from other parts of Spain as well.
Not at all. Seville also has an airport, and it's got two bus stations, so you've really got a good network to be able to explore the region. When I have friends come to visit, it's always fun for me to go back to the places that I like to see. Córdoba is only a 45-minute high-speed train ride away. Mm-hmm. And there you've got the mosque, you've got the Guadalquivir River, which also passes through. Exactly. You've got La Mezquita, which is, it's an old Arabic mosque that was kind of transplanted into a Catholic church as well. That's run by the archdiocese there. So it's kind of a strange juxtaposition between the two cultures, which is kind of a way to look at Spain as the melting pot that it is. Córdoba is also very famous for its festivals. It's got a flower festival. It has a really fun fair. And it's famous for its gastronomy as well, between the salmorejo, which is a cold-based tomato soup that's thick. It's made with bread. It's a little bit sweet. And they're also famous for a rolled pork loin that's fried, called a flamenquin.
So that's a different soup than a gazpacho, which is also Andalusian.
Exactly. The big difference there is that in gazpacho, you've got a few more ingredients between the tomatoes, mm-hmm. the cucumbers, the green peppers, whereas salmorejo has bread. You take out all the other vegetables and you add the garlic back in and the olive oil, and it's thicker. So it's not as refreshing as a gazpacho, but I would say it's tastier.
Okay.
Apart from Córdoba, Seville is also along what's called the Via de la Plata. Before all the Visigoths and the Moors and all of those different groups that have occupied southern Spain have moved in. Spain itself was called Lusitania, and it was run by the Romans. Mm-hmm. So the emperors Trajan and Hadrian were actually born near Seville in a town called Italica. And lots of commerce passed through that area because it's quite fertile for cattle, for grains, for wine, for olives. So you've got quite a few Roman ruins scattered around the area between Italica, which is one of the best preserved Roman towns in southern Spain. Mm-hmm. It's only about a 20-minute bus ride through the public bus system from Seville. You've got Carmona, which is about a 40-minute ride on the bus. Beautiful town with lots of churches, lots of festivals, a good music tradition. That was Carma back in the Roman times. And just 2 hours away from Seville is Mérida, which was once the seat of Lusitania. And that's a city that's famous for its Roman ruins, its Roman museum, lots of relics, lots of temples just kind of scattered between the apartment buildings, which is something that still fascinates me about Spain after all these years that I've been there. Apart from that, there are beaches nearby. You can get to the Doñana National Park, which is the largest national park in Europe, famous for its waterfowl, its marshes, its lynxes. And down that way, you've got a lot of really nice sandy beaches around the Cádiz area. Of course, Granada is a big draw to southern Spain with the Alhambra, which is a Moorish palace that was the last stronghold before the Moors were moved out of Spain in 1492 with the expulsion. A really lovely mountain town, and it's kind of more or less in the geographical center. So from Granada, you can also get to a lot of other nice white villages, the Pueblos Blancos. You can get to the coast, you can get to Malaga. So Seville is really a great jumping off point to go to other places in Andalusia, as well as Portugal. We're only about an hour and 15 minutes from the border of Portugal, and we've got different bus lines that run that way. So you're close to the Algarve, you're close to where the cork is produced.
And before we get as far as Portugal, let's rein this in just a little bit, because we haven't, the one place we haven't talked about yet is actually Seville itself.
Sevilla.
So what would you recommend somebody do in the city?
What's really great about Seville, Chris, is that it's a city that's flat, and the majority of the old city center, which is one of the largest in Europe, is actually pedestrian friendly. So it's a really nice place to just walk around, to take in the architecture, to sit and have a drink in a plaza, listen to the chatter, lots of shops and small churches to duck into. And it's a really beautiful city on its own, not to mention the historical significance that it has had in the discovery of the New World in the Roman times. You can just walk around the Barrio de Santa Cruz, which is the old Jewish quarter, and see Roman ruins just kind of sticking out at you. There's a big Islamic influence, the Renaissance, and it's a city that's kind of been able to retain a lot of its character throughout all of these changes, while still being a city that's become more modern, even since my first visit to Spain almost 10 years ago.
Okay. Well, let's get a little more specific. So we're going to do walking around. Where are we going to start?
The biggest attraction in Seville, I'd say, is the cathedral.
Right.
It is the largest Gothic cathedral in the entire world and the third largest Catholic place of worship in the entire world.
Right.
It was built on top of a mosque.
St. Paul's and St. Peter's, as I recall.
I believe so. And then you've got the Seville Cathedral, which is enormous. It's sprawling. It's reputed that Christopher Columbus was actually born there. So you get a lot of people kind of wandering in and out.
And may or may not be buried in the Seville Cathedral.
We don't know. It's one of those, it's kind of one of the urban legends. They also say that San Fernando, St. Ferdinand, the person who defeated the Moors in Seville to win back the city in the late 13th century. So they actually exhume his body every single year so that can come and see it on his saint day, which I believe is May 30th. So that's a local holiday. Everyone just lines up in the cathedral to see those remains, if there are remains. I'm into the macabre stuff, but haven't really taken the time to go and see him on my day off.
And we say Columbus may or may not be buried there. There is a body that they brought back from the New World that we were told was Christopher Columbus's. But if you're in the New World, they'll tell you, no, they got the wrong one. So,
yeah, it's believed that he could be in Seville. And people say it's just a body part. And in a town as traditional as Seville and as into the Catholic tradition as Seville, you see in all kinds of churches, lots of little relics from different saints, different deities, different all kinds of people. And it's kind of one of those things that I love about Seville, that as the city modernizes, it's got a really strong foothold in the past as well. So the cathedral is kind of the center of that Catholic tradition that we see in Seville, that Holy Week, as you've probably heard, is a big tourist draw. It's the largest Holy Week celebration in Spain. You literally cannot walk down the street because there are people parading giant relics around. They've got busts. They've got depictions of the last days of Christ. They've got the Virgin Mary weeping. And it's really an interesting thing to see. And I'm not into it. I have 10 days off of school and I get to travel. It's the kind of thing that you see people go about their business. And then all of a sudden, all of the focus is on these parades. Everyone knows the routes. Everyone knows the traditions. And the focal point of that is the cathedral itself, because all of the brotherhoods pass by there on their official route. They come in, they get blessed, and then they go back to their churches. It's a celebration that takes over the entire city, but one that really merits a visit. But I would, of course, say that you should book your lodging in advance, because it can get quite costly.
I could imagine that. We'll take a minute here to hear from our sponsor, which is DK Eyewitness Travel Guides. I mentioned I have 20 different guidebooks from the DK series, and one of the ones that I have is Spain. Spain is one of the larger ones that I have, Spain and France probably being the largest two. And I was having great fun going back through this guide, because this is the guide we used when we visited Sevilla. And so in the street-by-street map, for instance, of El Arenal, the area with the bullrink and the area on the river, I found my bookmark was entrance tickets to one of the places that we'd been to. I appreciated that the guidebook not only had cutaway views of both the Alcazar as well as the cathedral, as well as pictures of what the next thing we're going to talk about, the clock tower of the cathedral, looked like in four different phases of its construction, as well as having a great pictorial guide of regional food of southern Spain. So a very pictorial guide. That's one of the things I really love about the DK Eyewitness guidebooks, and the one I hold in my hand has been well loved and well used. Check out the DK Eyewitness travel guides at dk.com. The other thing that was notable for me with the cathedral was the clock tower, or the Giralda, in terms of being both large but also with the spiral ramp that runs up, the being not the narrow stairs like you get in a lot of the old clock towers, mm-hmm. where the when it was the mosque, as I recall, five times a day the person mm-hmm. who was going to lead the call to prayer would ride his horse up the tower to lead the
That's
call
right.
to prayer.
The Giralda is kind of the unofficial city symbol of Seville. Mm-hmm. It was at one time the largest building in Seville, and according to city ordinance, nothing could be built higher than the Giralda. Hmm. What happened when the cathedral was built, and the people who built it said, people are going to take us for crazy people because we're building this enormous place of worship over an old mosque. But what they did was they preserved the clock tower that has become a really integral part of the city. And it's something that you can look practically anywhere in Seville and you can see the Giralda itself. The legend says that the reason that there are ramps rather than stairs, as you mentioned, Chris, in most clock towers, is because the muezzin, the man who called the masses to prayer, was actually lame. So he wasn't able to climb stairs. And that's why they made ramps. So there are 32 ramps that go up to the top, and it's really worth climbing. It comes as part of the cathedral entrance fee. And I'd recommend taking in the Giralda from the foot in the Patio de los Naranjos, and from there, taking the climb so you can see the entire city.
And I'm going to make you translate where we're taking it in from.
The Patio de los Naranjos mm-hmm. is the central patio that was conserved from the time of the mosque, and it's full of orange trees, so it's so named the Orange Tree Patio.
Right. Very beautiful place, too. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So we start at the cathedral.
Yep.
And then where to?
Part of the historical complex, which is actually a UNESCO World Heritage Site, is also the Archivo de las Indias, mm-hmm. which is the archives from the New World, where because Seville is on the Guadalquivir River, and that's actually where seafarers set sail from for the New World, there is a building dedicated solely to the records from the New World, from maps to coins to relics. And you can get private tours. They're usually about midday between 10 and noon, just by walking in. And it's a really interesting place. I myself have not been there, but by all accounts, it's supposed to be really cool and a really interesting way to see how the city of Seville played such an integral role in the discovery of the New World. And just behind that building, on Avenida de la Constitución, or Constitution Avenue, is the Alcázar, which is Alcázar is a word for fortress, mm-hmm. but the Alcázar itself is actually a palace. It's still in use when the King of Spain and his family come into Seville. They stay in the top floor of the residence. The Alcázar, at its very humble beginnings, was used as a hunting palace and over time became a royal residence that was built onto. So you can kind of see the progression of Seville as a city between all of the different sorts of groups who ruled. You've got the Moorish influence, a very strong Islamic presence with words written in Arabic, with the Mudéjar arches. Mm-hmm. There's also a neoclassical element in the gardens and the baños, or the Arabic baths that are underneath the main structure. And apart from being a beautiful place to kind of take in Seville, the smell of the orange trees, the history of the city itself, the Alcázar does run quite a few concert series, movies in the park. It's really a cultural epicenter for Seville itself.
And for those who are not familiar, the pronunciation, the word we're pronouncing here doesn't look like it's being pronounced. So it looks like Alcazar.
Yes, exactly.
And then the other thing I think that's useful for us to know is you described the arches as being the Mudéjar style. And that's basically after the Reconquest, that is architecture that is done that is still in the style of the Muslim architecture. But one of the ways you can tell the difference is, for instance, if you see any letters or if you see any depictions of people or of animals or things like that, you know that it is post-Reconquest. If it's only the script verses from the Quran or geometric shapes, it might in fact be from before. So as I recall in the, I can't say Alcázar.
Alcázar,
as well as you can. But as I recall in that particular one, for instance, you'd see something that looks like it would be a Muslim thing, but then you'd see Isabel and Ferdinand's initials in it or something like that.
Exactly.
And so you could tell that it was from sometime later on.
And what's really interesting about this particular structure is that it's been used in so many films. And most recently, it was on the fifth season of Game of Thrones.
Huh.
So there was a lot of buzz, I'd say in September or October of 2014. I've personally never seen the show. And lots of actors moving in and out. And I think it'll be interesting to see how this particular building is portrayed in a fictional setting, because it really is a good testament to the history of Seville and the different sorts of people who have come through the Renaissance and the Baroque. So it's definitely worth a visit. It's a bit costly. It's about $8, but definitely worth going into the Alcázar, because you can spend as much time as you'd like in there as well.
Okay, excellent. And then after we do that, where are we off to?
From the Alcázar, you're close to what's called the Jewish Quarter, or the Barrio Santa Cruz. This is what I like to describe as a Spanish Disney World. And I mean that in the best sense of the word, simply because it's so close to all of the main attractions that you've got touristic bars where you see the menus translated into many different languages, and often poorly. There are a lot of touristic shops, lots of souvenirs, people trying to peddle you fans. You see gypsies trying to give you a sprig of rosemary. But it's a good example of what they call the tres culturas, or the three cultures that existed in Seville between the Christians, the Jews, and the Moors back in the 12th and 13th centuries. It's a neighborhood that's got the cobblestone streets, the narrow alleyways, the beautiful plazas that kind of just open up out of nowhere with the fountains, the smell of the orange trees. It's very romantic, if not a bit touristic, but it merits a walk around. And that way you're still within the complex of the historical center.
And isn't that the area where I would tend to find more flamenco music too, if I'm there later in the evening?
It really depends. Seville is definitely known as the cradle of, Andalusia itself is the cradle of flamenco music.
Mm-hmm.
It's believed to have originated between Cádiz, between Jerez, between the town of Utrera, which is halfway between Seville and the coast. And there are quite a few what are called tablaos, which are bars that have flamenco music. They're often staged, but you can find a lot of good shows within the Barrio Santa Cruz. I'd recommend Los Gallos. It's a well-established tablao that's got pretty good dancers. It's a decent price. You'll often get a drink included within the cost of your entrance ticket. And then you're not seeing the free shows, which are fine, but often have kind of the leftover dancers who have kind of passed their prime. One that sticks out in my mind is La Carbonería. And what's great about this place in particular is that they have shows every night, but it's often not good flamenco.
Okay.
Another place to consider seeing flamenco is in the neighborhood of Triana, which is actually where I live. It's the old gypsy and seafarers neighborhood. It's got not so many touristic places, but it's a neighborhood that you can walk around and you can feel like a local. Lots of great bars, little hole-in-the-wall places to some more gastro bars that are starting to kind of become synonymous with the tapas scene in Seville. You've also got all of the ceramic factories over in that way and some really cool markets as well. So I tend to walk people through Triana more than I do through Santa Cruz.
Okay. And you mentioned tapas, and we were going to get there eventually, but we might as well define it near where you first used the term.
Okay.
So we do have that issue, and I ran into this when I was in Spain. I've mentioned this on other shows before. If we didn't change to the Spanish schedule, which is a mistake, because that meant we were out looking for some place to eat a real sit-down dinner at maybe 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock or something like that, when you can only find a tourist restaurant, which is almost guaranteed a bad meal. So tell me more about what I should have done.
I think it's safe to say that food is one of the things that's synonymous all throughout Spain. It's a country that's got a lot of different languages and dialects. It's got a very varied history. But one thing that Spaniards are passionate about is food and drink. So because they love food and drink so much, they tend to eat several times a day. Maybe that's why they're all so skinny. Maybe it's because I smoke. Maybe it's because I walk everywhere. But when I make my social plans, it often revolves around food or drink. Typically, Spaniards will eat a light breakfast at home before they go to work. And then most offices give their employees a 30-minute break to have a coffee and a toast. Usually on the toast, you get the extra virgin olive oil, which is all manufactured down in southern Spain for the most part because of the abundance of olive trees. Mm-hmm. You might throw a little bit of Iberian ham on there. You might have tomato. My personal breakfast of choice has cheese and tomato along with the olive oil. And that typically occurs between 10 and 11, even push it into noon. The biggest meal of the day is lunch, where you've got the big hearty soups, typically 2 to 3 courses, a dessert with a coffee afterwards. That's called la comida, and you eat that between 2 and 4. There is no such thing as a light lunch. There is no such thing as grabbing a sandwich and getting back to work.
Although that's changing somewhat, isn't it?
It depends, and I think it's retained its importance in southern Spain, whereas in some of the more industrial areas like Madrid or even Bilbao, people are tending to take shorter lunches because for ages, the siesta culture really ruled. So people would have 2 to 3 to 4 hours in the middle of the day because it was hot, because they would go home to have lunch with their families, and simply because in the middle of the day, not a lot gets done.
And when we say hot, we're talking about in Seville, in the heat of the summer, we're talking 104, 42 degrees Celsius, something along those lines.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it didn't even start to get chilly in Seville in 2014 until November, mid-November. So for someone from Chicago, it's unbearable. I usually don't stick around in the summertime simply because I can't. My body just won't take it, and not every house has air conditioning. So most people head to the beach, and Seville is virtually a ghost town in the month of August.
Okay, so they finished their big meal by 4 o'clock.
Yeah, more or less.
So they're clearly not going to be having dinner like I was at 6 or 7.
No, not at all. At 6 or 7, you should be having what's called the merienda, or a sweet snack that's usually taken with coffee. Spaniards like pastries. I grew up with a sweet tooth, and as soon as I moved to Spain and tasted their pastries, they're flaky, they're sugary, they don't seem to have much substance, but you get your merienda at 6 or 7. Most people used to start to get out of work around 8 o'clock, and that's when you'd go for a beer and maybe a tapa before you headed home to have a light meal for dinner.
And usually when you say about 10 a tapa, so going to make you define it. I think a lot of people know tapas now. It's more popular than just Spain now, but let's not assume everyone does.
A tapa is essentially a small dish. Mm-hmm. At its very basic, it's either a hot or cold dish that is served with a drink. There's a lot of origins to how the tapa came to be. They're believed to have been made popular in southern Spain. And I would say that the tapas culture in southern Spain is much different than it is in other parts of Spain, where it's more common to share big plates of meal between people rather than ordering lots of small plates.
But, and my understanding is it used to be just a little tiny dish maybe on top of your beer to keep the flies out, and then they'd put some nuts on top for you to have something salty to eat or something to make you a little more thirsty for a second beer. And then that has evolved into some olives or some variety.
Potato chips.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. And unfortunately, Seville isn't like Granada or Almería in the sense that it's common to get a little snack with your drink. There are places that might put out some nuts or some potato chips or olives even, but a lot of times you'll have to ask for them. and nothing really comes for free. There is a really great place in Triana that's called Cervecería La Grande. It's got a red and white awning, and it's on the pedestrian street just off of the bridge that goes to Triana. And they serve you 3 shrimp with each beer that you order. So a lot of times we'll head there just for a little snack after work before we go home and either have lunch or have dinner.
And this is, by my count, about the 5th time we have eaten during the day by this point.
Exactly.
And we're still at 8 o'clock.
I would say closer to 10.
Closer to 10 o'clock.
Yeah. I actually, since I work in the evenings, tend to eat dinner after 11. And it's maybe some soup or a piece of fruit and yogurt. It's nothing heavy because then I go to bed right away. So the big meal of the day, the long meal, the meal where you meet with your friends and you have what's called the sobremesa, or the topics that you talk about with a full stomach, maybe with a glass of wine, that's in the middle of the day between 2 and 4.
Excellent. And then you had mentioned you leave town in the summer. What is the best time of year to come to Seville, to Sevilla?
Seville is a city with a lot of extremes. So I would not come in June, July, or August if you can avoid it. And even the first half of September tends to be pretty hot. I usually recommend to people that they come between mid-March and mid-April.
Okay.
That's a mild time of the year where the olive blossoms are beginning to bloom. The city smells amazing. You've got lots of people in the street. Someone once told me that civilians are the sorts of people who consider their living room to be the street, or a bar, or a courtyard and a plaza. So there's always a lot of people out. You'll see people hunched under heat lamps in the dead of winter just because they like eating outside. They like having their beer outside. Or the country of Spain itself is smoke-free, so you can't smoke in public buildings. So you see people miserable because they're so cold out. The only thing to do is, well, if I want to have my cigarette or I want to sit here and have the sun on my face while I'm drinking a beer, I just have to deal with the cold, because what's more important is being with my friends, having a beer, and the sunshine. In the spring, we also have our 2 big festivals.
Okay, that was my next question.
Yep. Holy Week is the entire week from Palm Sunday until Resurrection Sunday. So you've got all of the big churches in Seville, and even in all of the cities and towns that surround Seville, they've got their own celebrations, but Seville's is the big draw. It's very traditional. They have counts of these brotherhoods that are called hermandades, dating back to the 11th or 12th century. So they've got their relics. They parade them around. Everyone goes and dresses in their Sunday finest to see these brotherhoods parade these enormous statues around. And you have to practice. You'll see people out in the streets in the middle of the winter carrying big cinder blocks on top of these floats to start to get used to carrying that heavy weight. You'll see bands practicing for it. And it's, as an American, it's kind of a jarring sight to see the penitent who are dressed like the Ku Klux Klan. But it's actually a way to not identify those people who are doing their penitence, because they wear these cloaks and these big pointed hats and you can't see their faces. So it's something that you should see, especially if you live in Spain. But I tend to like the April fair better. Things that I like to do are drink and dance.
And when you say the penitents, you didn't mention what they were doing. You said they were wearing their hoods, but how are they showing that they are penitent?
Each brotherhood has its set of traditions that go back centuries, Chris. So you might see people who carry heavy wooden crosses. You might see people who are barefoot. There are also brotherhoods that practice silence. They don't talk. There's no band. They expect the people in the crowds to be silent as well. So in 60 different brotherhoods within the city of Seville, there's a lot of really cool, what we call culto, or secret traditions that that kind of set each brotherhood apart. Apart from the different Virgin Marys that they carry, apart from the different songs that they play, apart from the way that they march or the way that their tunics look. So if you're really into it, you're really into it. And if you're not, like me, you tend to prefer the festival that starts 2 weeks after Holy Week, which is the Feria de Abril, or the April Fair. This particular celebration started off as a livestock market. And when the men were doing their trading, someone had the brilliant idea that these guys are going to get hungry. They're going to get thirsty. So I'm going to set up a little tent where they can sit down, they can have a refreshment, they can have a plate of food to eat. And it's grown into just an enormous street party. You see the women dress in their flamenco dresses. They dance flamenco in the streets. Men dress in their riding costumes. There are horse carriage parades. And it's pretty much a week of hedonism right after the somber festival that is Holy Week. The April Fair in Seville is known for being a little bit snooty. So a lot of people come with the misconception that they can just waltz in and out of these tents that they have. There's about 1,000 tents in the district that holds the fair. All of those are private. Not all of them. Mm-hmm. I would say 90% of the tents are private. So you've got to know someone who's inside, or you kind of have to sweet talk the bouncer. But once you get inside, it's pretty much a celebration of things that are Andalusian, from the wine to the horses to the music to the regional costume. And I'm not really into the Holy Week. I really love the fair, and it's something that I look forward to every year. I myself own 2 flamenco dresses. So
excellent.
A lot of fun.
And all of that, we got interrupted there as we were walking through the Barrio Santa Cruz. Anything else that we want to do to finish our walk through Sevilla?
Seville has kind of gone through a transformation in the last 10 years that it's always been known for being a traditional city, mm-hmm. a beautiful city, but not a modern city. So the previous mayor started plans to modernize the city by adding a tram, by adding a metro and an underground network. And one of the biggest points of contention of the previous mayor's tenure as mayor was that he built this enormous wooden structure. It's one of the largest wooden structures in the world, called the Metrosol Parasol. But us Sevillanos call it Las Setas, or the mushrooms, because it essentially looks like a big waffle cone. And you can take the elevator up. You can see some pretty commanding views. I actually tend to tell people to see the Setas before they go to the Giralda, so that they can see the view of Sevilla with this building that's kind of become the city symbol. But the Setas were built, I'd say, in 2009. The builders got a lot of flack. The city got a lot of flack for kind of changing the face of Seville, so to speak, because you have a city that's known for being traditional and being very Spanish. And all of a sudden, you've got this big eyesore in the center of the downtown area. I think people are starting to come around to the Setas, especially since Roman mosaics were discovered right underneath. So according to city ordinance, those ruins had to be preserved. So there's actually a nice museum underneath the Setas, and they've used that space kind of as a cultural center. So you can go and watch a big football match there. You can shop in the market that's there. There's a few nice bars and cocktail bars there. And apart from that, the views from the top are really great, and you get a drink included. So you could go up there and have a coffee and enjoy a view of the city across the river to Triana. You see the Giralda. You can see the Plaza de España, which is also mm-hmm. a must-see when you go to Spain.
I actually missed the Plaza de España when
You're
we were
kidding.
There. We were through Spain in a hurry. So
that's too bad.
And that's leftover from, no, I was going to say a World's Fair, but a fair, not a World's Fair, though.
Exactly. The 1929 Ibero-American Fair was held in Seville. So the country of Spain was still under a monarch at that time. So this monarch, Alfonso XIII, commanded that a big park be erected to hold all of the crowds. And each of the buildings that surrounds the Plaza de España itself were meant to house exhibitions from cities in and countries in South and Central America. The plaza itself was kind of built as the Spain Pavilion. So you've got a half moon plaza with 2 towers on each side. And there are beautiful ceramic benches all around that half circle that tell the story of a different province in Spain. So each province of Spain, there's 40 some of them, have their most important moment immortalized in the ceramic that was manufactured in Seville, hand-painted in Seville. And it's a really nice place to sit and reflect. It unfortunately also houses the foreigner's office. So it's like a thorn in my side to have to go there because I have to deal with paperwork issues with my visa. But at the same time, you've got a really beautiful plaza that's been featured in several movies like The Dictator and Star Wars Episode One. It kind of crowns what's known as the Maria Luisa Park, which is the city's green lung, an enormous park with lots of beautiful fountains. It's got a few museums in there as well. So it's a nice way to kind of get out of the city and see a part of the city's recent history.
Mm-hmm.
And then Seville also held the 1992 Ibero-American Fair in the area that's known as La Cartuja, but that unfortunately has fallen into ruins. So there's not really much to see on that northern end of the city, except for pavilions and cracked sidewalks and kind of a very poor use of public space.
Okay.
So I'd steer clear.
As we start to think about wrapping this up a little bit, is anything mm-hmm. any other neighborhoods or sites you want to take us to in Seville before I ask some of our more general questions?
Yes. There's a part of Seville just behind the Setas that's called Macarena, just like the song, which is actually written about the famous Virgen de la Macarena, or the Macarena Virgin, who takes up residence in Seville. That area has kind of seen a gentrification. About 10 or 12 years ago, it was known as a place where there were seedy people, seedy businesses, and it's kind of had its own renaissance. And there's a lot of really cool boutiques, a lot of nice restaurants back there. Especially along a big plaza that's called the Alameda. So you can take a stroller. It's a really nice place to just stop and have a beer, pop into some shops, have a tapa. And sandwiched right between the Setas and the Alameda is what's called Soho Bendita, which is kind of Seville's take on Soho in New York. So that's where you've got a lot of the pop-up shops. They're starting to brew beer back there. Lots of cool cultural things going on, poetry readings, shops, even really interesting bookstores or furniture stores. So it's definitely worth a stop if you like shopping. And you've got really everything you need right there. And it's within walking distance of the shopping district on Calle Sierpes and the conjunction of the cathedral, the Archivo de las Indias, and the Alcázar itself. So as I mentioned before, Seville is very walkable. The city center is enormous, but it's really easy to get around.
Answer this question for me. You're standing in the prettiest spot in Seville. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
I am standing on Calle Betis, mm-hmm. just next to a big yellow building that's called El Faro. And I'm looking at the Triana Bridge lit up at night.
Hmm. As you moved to Seville, what was the moment you realized that you had become a... And I'm interested to note that you had two different words for it, a civilian or a Sevillano.
I think that I live with one foot in each bucket, that mm-hmm. I feel very American living in Spain, and I also feel very civilian or Sevillana living in Seville. I don't know that there was ever a moment where I thought, this is a place for me. This is why I live here. I love being here, because when you've got family back home and your traditions, you can never fully be from one place. And for me, I think when I got a full-time job after the teaching program, I had a steady group of friends. I had a flamenco dress and I knew how to dance Sevillanas.
That seems like a fairly significant, yeah.
It took me a few years to really feel settled, but I don't think that I'd be happier living anywhere else in Spain.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Seville.
I have moments like that. It seems like every other minute. I got hit by a car once. And I'm from Chicago. I'm used to driving in all kinds of elements.
Sure.
And when I got hit by a car in Seville, I just kind of threw up my hands and said, well, I must really be from here because people drive erratically. People don't watch where they're going. People don't pay attention to stop signs. And I was in a crosswalk, kind of bowled over an old lady and said, well, that's the end of it. Either that or when I saw the recently deceased Duquesa de Alba. Cayetana de Alba is one of Spain's most flamboyant characters in recent history. And I saw her riding in her horse carriage at the April Fair. And I thought, oh, okay, this is the moment that I feel like I live here. Like that's the one thing that I had to do in my Seville bucket list. And what's really funny is there's a website that's kind of taken a lot of hold in the last few years called Postureo de Sevilla. And Postureo is just things that are very typical. And what's really funny about Seville is that people tend to be a little bit fake. They're pretentious. They think very highly of themselves. But when it really boils down to it, what they like is a cheap beer. What they like is a serranito sandwich, which is just a pork loin on the grill with mm-hmm. some mayonnaise on it. And one thing that's kept me in Seville for so long, Chris, is just that I feel like I can be myself and kind of go a little bit further than that. And I've taken on a lot of mannerisms that are typical of Seville, from the handshakes to the expressions, even just being out here in the States.
You say the handshakes.
Yeah, they do these handshakes, kind of saying, oh, it's no big deal. But that's supposed to mean like, oh, that person is just way out of line. Or they've got lots of hand gestures just to signify things from ordering the check to saying, let's go, to saying, I have no money. And I tend to come back from Spain and be in the States and have sort of a weird way of communicating with people who've known me my entire life because I use these expressions, or I might say a word that doesn't exist in English, but I've kind of taken that word from Spanish and added, if I want to make a noun, I might add shun to the end of it. So I don't feel like I could fit in the States as easily anymore, but I know that I'll never fit in Seville as a Sevillana. And they tend to be close-knit with their friends growing up. My fiance's best friend has been his best friend for 30 years. So it's kind of tough to get into those social circles. But once you're in for life. I feel very fortunate to have a good, solid group of friends, both expat friends and Spanish friends.
Before we get to my last two questions, anything else we should know before we go to Seville?
Seville is also known for its bullfighting culture. So if you're intrigued with that sort of artistry, the animal cruelty issue aside, the bullring does run tours. It's a beautiful building built about 150 years ago. And they do run tours in English on the hour, and usually in the summer on the half an hour as well. And it's kind of an interesting insight into how modern bullfighting started and how the tradition is kept alive in Seville.
Excellent. Last two questions. Finish the sentence. You really know you're in Seville when what?
You step in dog poop. People do not clean up after their dogs, but they consider it to be lucky. So
they not consider all it to be lucky?
Yeah. You should just watch your step.
Okay. I think that's a different answer to that question of all the ones I've got. If you had to summarize Seville in three words, hopefully not including the words dog poop, what three words would you use?
Traditional.
Okay.
Gorgeous.
Okay.
And sweltering.
Excellent.
It's really hot.
Where can people read about your travels?
I have a personal blog that's kind of a curated love letter to Southern Spain and to Spanish culture called Sunshine and Siestas. Sunshineandsiestas.com covers everything from Spanish language to teaching in Spain to Spanish food, which I write about biweekly, as well as different day trips, cultural notes. It's kind of a big old mess of why I love Spain so much. And I write as if I were talking to someone.
And your favorite post that you did recently?
I wrote a post that I love going back and reading every so often called The Expat Dilemma. And it's kind of the issue of living in two places, having your heart in two different cities, and kind of coming to terms with being from a place and living in a different place. And that's kind of the expat dilemma, that am I doing this right? Is this where I want to be? Is there anywhere else for me? And I think when it comes down to it, Seville is the place that I need to be and that I want to be right now. And it is the place that I have to be because I have a mortgage. But apart from that, it's a city that I feel very fortunate to have landed in. And I kind of explore those feelings within that post.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Kat Gay. Thanks so much for coming on The Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your obvious love for Seville.
Gracias a ti.
I do have one news story for you, and it's kind of a belated Christmas story. Some cross between people behaving badly on the plane and Scrooge, because a man got kicked off a plane because people wished him Merry Christmas. Now, I understand that not everybody celebrates Christmas, but but apparently this man started shouting at first the first person who wished him Merry Christmas, then went on the plane and was greeted by a second flight attendant who also wished him a Merry Christmas, and he started lecturing the flight attendants. They tried to calm him down, and he refused to back down and continued hectoring him. He was finally escorted off the plane to the cheers and applause of the other passengers. You can debate what the appropriate greeting is at the holidays, but it sounded like a man who needed a little more eggnog. In News of the Community, we had the trippy question of last week, which was, what's your favorite comfort food you have had on the road? I'll have to say I was a little surprised by the number one answer, which was Prague. Tiffany from Washington, D.C. said, Prague does heavy meats and potatoes incredibly well. I ate duck almost every night, served with vegetables and potatoes. It was heavy, flavorful, and warmed me up. I think my problem must have been I didn't have the duck. We had votes for Thailand, even for the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas. Although I'd have to say that Joanna of Oakland, who voted for a New Mexican restaurant called Maria's in Santa Fe that had a green chili stew, that's the one that I want to try. Although I'm with Ben from the United Kingdom that a kebab is always great wherever you have it. You can check out those answers again at amateurtraveler.com/trippy6. With that, we're going to end this episode of the Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. Remember to check out our sponsor, DK Eyewitness Travel Guides. And once again, the transcript of this episode will be available in a few weeks, and that is sponsored by J-Way Travel, leaders in Eastern European travel. You can follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
One more cathedral, I got to sit in one more cafe.